Hi, welcome to the Imperial Healthcare Business Podcast. My name is Ibi Adejugo. Today we'll be discussing healthcare management with a medical director. Her name is Dr. Leela Dina. She's a well-accomplished consultant anaesthetist, and she's also a medical director at Stanmore Hospital. Very welcome, Leela.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So we'll just be asking you a few questions. So just tell us about your career path so far in terms of becoming a medical director. What managerial roles have you held?
Well, I think I've got a slightly unusual career into being a medical director. I had a lot of management roles in education and in appraisal. Within my trust and within my region, and some work at the Royal College, but hadn't actually held a formal medical management role until 2017. And so I then became a medical director in 2019. And I think perhaps for me, what I learned was that, first of all, there are lots of transferable skills, and that actually I've been managing a very large training program, and a lot of the management skills that I'd learned during that, and doing a lot of external quality inspections. I'd done stuff for the college and the stuff for the GMC around that. So a lot of the skills, I suppose, that I'd learned during that were very useful going into medical management. But I think the more traditional route is going through the kind of clinical lead role, perhaps clinical director, divisional director. So I went straight in as divisional director and then got a medical director job after that. I don't know that it matters. I have read that most people who become medical directors don't intend to become medical directors, and that's certainly my scenario. I certainly had no career plan to become a medical director.
So just talk us through what a typical day as a medical director is like. You know, what do you start off with? Is it meetings, or are you reviewing different documents, or what's your normal day like?
Well, I think that's one of the features. So there is no normal day. There is a weekly rhythm where there are some structured, you know, there are some regular meetings, of course, that form the backbone of your working week. I think so. My typical day starts somewhere around 7:30, and I will sometimes meet, because I work in a surgical hospital. People do start early, so it's quite good to be able to meet people if I need to meet a one-to-one. So sometimes it's before, might be 7 or 7:30, that I meet with people, because that's the time that I don't mind doing and they can do. I typically don't have meetings start till 8, but I typically do have meetings on from 8. The meetings are kind of interspersed, I suppose, with either one-to-ones. I have an office that's in the main body of the hospital, which is actually separate from the rest of the executive team, which is quite an interesting, perhaps, quirk, maybe, of this particular setup. In my hospital, it's not the case everywhere, but I think quite commonly the medical director is either a member of the consultant body, or as in my case, I've come into a hospital. But nevertheless, having kind of easy access, medical director, be accessible, I suppose, to the medical body is really important. So quite often get people just popping in to tell me things, and I think that's really important. My day will go on. I often have meetings going on into the evening, so wouldn't necessarily finish meetings till perhaps 7, and then I'm off in here after that. So I have a 4-day-a-week commitment as a medical director, but I think that's the thing. It's one of these jobs that the work expands to fill any time you could possibly give it.
Yeah, I know. It sounds like a very varied day, basically ready for anything, like with anaesthesia, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just for our listeners who don't know, who probably wouldn't have understood what you meant when you said college, that's the Royal College of Anaesthetists.
It is,
and
yeah.
That's also the health education body that you worked for or with before you became a medical director. So tell us, how do you juggle being a medical director, and how do you maintain your managerial work? How do you combine them all?
With being a clinical, my clinical responsibility. Well, for me, it is perhaps easier than some people because I do my clinical responsibilities in a different hospital. And so I have a 1 day a week clinical commitment to a different hospital where I, and that is because my specialty, I can't undertake my specialty at the Royal National Orthopaedic Hospital. So when I took this job, I made clear that I needed to keep those two things. There is a move, I think, within medical management generally to, I suppose, professionalize it and make it a career of its own, and move away from the medical director doing it as a little bit on top of a full-time clinical job. And as that move happens, I think it's important to understand whether you should keep clinical work. It's not essential. You are generally a very senior doctor by the time you would be eligible to apply or be successful at application as a medical director. And as such, I don't think you need to continue your clinical work to keep clinical credibility. But I think it's really good, myself, my experience, it's really important for your sanity, frankly, to have some downtime. I think if you are in the same institution, that's really important too, because, you know, you get a sense of what's going on as a clinician on the ground. And I do lack that here, but the difference, I suppose, is that actually I am very visible and present, and also work in a, you know, I think because it is a largely surgical hospital, I have a kind of good understanding, having spent my whole career working in an operating theatre environment. So I don't think that it is a problem. I think it may be a problem if you worked in a, you know, if I went to work in a mental health trust or something, then I think that can be more difficult. The principles of medical management, the same as principles of all kinds of management, where in theory it's the skill set and being able to get to grips with your brief and understanding your brief does not necessarily require you to have had to do that thing before. And that concept that you've got a transferable skill and can move between areas of healthcare. And you see people moving outside healthcare indeed with the same skill set.
Yeah, and you just answered some of my next questions, actually, which is the fact that, you know, as you correctly said, coming from a different specialty and the dynamics of understanding the specialty that you're not well immersed in, you know, whilst that can be a challenge, you've actually made that work for you. And I suspect that's based on relationships you've built with the people around you and just experience over time in itself.
Well, I think it is partly that. I think it's also, to some extent, it's the language one speaks. You know, I think if you speak and understand the language, it's clearly easier. By that I mean, I think within the world of healthcare, there is a broad understanding, I suppose, and one could then go in. I mean, I feel it's not impossible to conceive of going into an organisation doing something completely different to my particular specialty background and being able to get to grips with that. It's clearly easier if you don't have to do that, but it's perfectly possible, I think, within medicine to do that. And you do see people coming from mental health backgrounds or community backgrounds into acute providers at medical director level and making it very successful. You need to be interested in what is the business at hand, and then you need and learn about it, willing to learn about it.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more, because I think it's the interest that means that you see what other people don't see, because you're inquisitive about stuff. So that comes on to my next question. So where do you see your role in terms of the strategy of the organization? Are you in a role where you're building goals and strategy for moving forward with the organization?
Well, yes, I am. And I think I think it's, again, it's part perhaps of the move to professionalize the medical director role. The medical director role is a board position, and so you inevitably you're almost always in most organisations a voting member of the board, and therefore you do bear some of the both legal and moral, I suppose, responsibility for the direction that the organisation takes and the strategy that the organisation comes to. But I think the business of a hospital or a healthcare provider is healthcare. And therefore, if you don't use those people who are most immersed in healthcare, which I do think of people from a clinical background, you couldn't possibly formulate a strategy that actually makes sense on the front line. And then you would fail, I think, to be able to deliver properly. And again, it's about kind of engaging your stakeholders, understanding your audience, understanding the temperature of the organisation. The consultant body particularly is an enormously important feature of any hospital setting. They are people who are invested in the organisation for often 20 to 30 years, and that often sets them apart from management structures, management people often not staying for so long in an organisation and moving on. So I think it's a critical part of your role, actually, to be engaged in trying to develop the strategy. I think it's an important thing, and yes, I have a role where that is part of what I'm doing. It's also, I suppose, a feature maybe of the COVID pandemic that I think all organisations are kind of using this time to both relook at what they are about and how we all interact with each other, and obviously what with the white paper being leaked and the changes to the, you know, those proposals. But I mean, of course, that's going to change, I think, for some people, the strategic direction of their organisations.
Yeah. And that brings me to the next question in terms of the role as being a manager and setting strategy and then actually implementing that strategy. So how do you influence and create impact in the delivery of healthcare at the ground level? You know, how do you translate that?
Well, I'm very struck, I suppose, in all of the kind of positions I've held by the impact of silos and how that limits the ways in which change can actually be affected. So I work really closely with my chief operating officer and my chief finance officer, because I think those are really key people to actually affect change. And so you've got the kind of clinical the quality, the clinical governance, the quality patient safety aspects, where you typically work very closely with the chief nurse and the quality leads. But in terms of affecting change around strategy and direction, it's often the chief operating officer and the chief finance officer, I think, that where that really lies. And for me, if you want to make something happen, you've got to engage your audience as to why that's important. And so much now is driven around financial sustainability. And it's still an amazement how little financial information is shared with clinical teams. And actually, if you don't have a really good understanding of the financial position, the clinical teams can look at their finances and actually will come up with solutions, will come up with efficiencies. Equally, they are full of ideas, because people who work in a place know exactly how to fix the problems. And it's the operational team's job, in a way, to facilitate those, to make those happen. So the difficulty a bit, I think, is that there's been a lot of change management, project management put into the NHS over the years, often by external, very expensive, often organisations who don't necessarily have the... don't have perhaps the buy-in of the clinical body. So you've got to get the buy-in of the clinical body, but you'll get it if you come from a kind of ground up, solution focused, stone, what's the stone in your shoe? What do you think is the solution? Let me show you what the impact on activity or finances are. How can we make this work? And I think there's a big move about improvement technology, sorry, methodology. So again, I'm really keen on encouraging that and working through that. So I've come from an organization where that was very embedded to an organization where it's very naive still around those. So that's very exciting. That's nice.
Yeah, and I'm very excited to hear about that, because that's something that's quite important in these times that we're in, that we find local solutions to local problems, like you said. So the intrapreneurship. And like you correctly said, the NHS has pushed a lot to get innovation going and get people engaged. And, you know, just like you narrated, in terms of trying to get people to see the vision that you that you're setting, that's part of the role of engaging people in that process as well, because they're far more likely to implement it if they've helped to come up with the idea itself. So then that brings me to sort of the pandemic. What has been your biggest challenges during this pandemic as a medical director? Dare I ask?
I think that the biggest challenge is probably the role of this particular hospital. So I happen to work in a specialist trust, and indeed both in my clinical and my medical director job, I work in two separate specialist trusts, and they have a very particular role within the NHS, which doesn't massively fit with how do you manage a global pandemic, which for which you need all hands on deck sort of thing. And so the real challenge is getting people who have become increasingly specialist, and for whom that's a real pride and the sort of raison d'etre of both the individual and the organisation, to appreciate that actually the role has to change. So my biggest challenges have been, I suppose, managing my stakeholder group, which are the consultant body largely and the medical body, but also kind of encouraging and working with the executive team to say, actually, yes, we are able to spin on a penny and convert really quickly to doing something that we've never done before. So so my biggest challenge, I suppose, we became a trauma hospital in the first wave. There's not been trauma in this hospital since 1982. So that was a huge challenge, actually. To kind of encourage and support people to do something that they hadn't done for perhaps ever, for a very long time. So I think that was perhaps a bit different to some of the other organisations. And in this second pandemic, we've become a COVID hospital, which we're just as full of COVID and COVID ITU. Again, something completely out with the experience of nearly everybody here. And so the challenge has been, that's been extremely, extremely difficult, actually, to persuade people that this is the right thing to do. And it is interesting that it's five, 6 weeks down the line from that particular change, and the mood has changed utterly from extraordinarily hostile, actually, to feeling quite proud of themselves and feeling quite proud of the organisation. And there are massive benefits from that kind of flexibility, because actually you accidentally upskill in all sorts of areas. I wouldn't think it was the best thing to do in your first year as medical director.
And you know, it's amazing you said that, but I actually think that's a good example of your exemplary leadership, in that you saw a need and you were able to motivate your team, even when they may not have been on your side to start with, but to then turn around to the position where, you know, they're actually proud of the work they're doing. And as you correctly said, upskilling them in areas they haven't used in many years, that's a phenomenal achievement, actually. And it means that the skills of the hospital and the things that the hospital can offer possibly in the future has increased. And I think, you know, often this is a dichotomy as a leader. You know, setting a vision that people may not buy into and how you get everyone on the same page. And I think it sounds like you've achieved that. So, you know,
I think COVID's done that for lots of hospitals, hasn't it? And lots of parts of our, you know, economy generally, you see that even, I mean, you know, in all sorts of areas, people have sort of forced to look at what else could I do? How could I diversify and still survive through COVID? And in a way, this is that some version of what's happened.
Yeah, and it's steering the ship really in the right direction, either against the wind, with the wind, but still in the right direction.
Well, yes, and I think yeah, of course, and I mean that is very much. I don't know if you're going to be asking me this, but I'm going to be offering you this answer anyway, which is, you know, it sort of goes to the heart of what you need in a way to be able to do a job like this, which I think it actually is a lot of resilience a kind of, yes, absolutely, some concept of what is the vision that you're trying to set. I think this would be an incredibly difficult job, but also an incredibly unrewarding job if you simply mechanistically did the work without any sense of what is the strategy that I'm trying to get, what is the vision of where are we trying to get to.
So what do you think have been the financial challenges, either for you as a trust, as a hospital, or just in general, you know, with the NHS during this pandemic? Because there's been a lot of money raised. There's been a lot of money being pumped into the NHS, which has magically appeared from nowhere.
Well, it's interesting because there hasn't. There was a lot in the first wave about, you know, spend whatever money you like, do whatever you need to do, and we will fund it. And a surprising amount of that money, not really surprising, has never in fact been forthcoming. There has been money that's been written off. There have been all sorts of things. I think that we all know that the overall, and it's worldwide really, the overall spend on COVID has been phenomenal. And the overall position of the NHS was anyway fairly dire, every organisation pretty much in financial deficit. I think it's been in some ways bizarrely and amazingly refreshing to have a period where you were able to spend money as you felt you needed to do things. And what did that reveal? It revealed that you can actually be hugely agile, you can make change really quickly, you can fix that problem that needs fixing immediately, and actually you're more efficient as a result. And so what's intriguing, I suppose, for me is to see how that plays out nationally going forwards. Because actually that's one of the great benefits of this period, where we've been able to do stuff really quickly and make change happen really quickly. And stuff that's been talked about for decades, actually, in terms of service changes, has just happened. And the danger slightly is that people slide backwards. But the absence of money and the financial constraints, again, put a brake on spending in order to save, investing in order to recoup or make more. So but that is the reality. So the reality is our organization, like every other organization, is even deeper in financial deficit, that there is a cost improvement program and cost improvement targets for next year, as there would always have been, but which we nowhere near achieved this last year. That the financial climate, the financial arrangements rather, have not been sorted out. And we know that we'll be operating to some extent within a constrained financial envelope again. So I suppose it's a bit watch this space, everybody being a little bit nervous as to really what the impact is going to be. Some of the stick that was there before for organisations who overspent, as it were, or who didn't. It's not about spend, really. It's about prediction. I mean, that's one of the interesting things I've learned. It doesn't actually matter, she said slightly cynically, how bad your overspend is. It's how good you are at managing, how good you are at predicting where you'll come in at the end of the year, how good you are at managing your budget. So if you say, I'm going to save 10p, you must save 10p. Don't save 9p because you're judged to be very, you know, you're really on the naughty step. But if that's 9p out of a deficit of £1,000,000,000, that's okay. It's about your governance, essentially, of your financial environment. So that's where, for me, who spends the money? Well, the money is largely spent by clinicians. It's largely spent on clinical stuff. Outside salaries, it's largely spent on clinical stuff. So if you want to save money and you want to spend it efficiently, you want to get your clinical teams to really understand their money position, because they will be the people who will mostly help to get you out of trouble.
Yeah, I think you couldn't have articulated that better, in that I think clinicians really need to get a better understanding of the finances of the NHS and of all the services that we provide, so we're better stewards over the services that we do provide. So then that brings me on to, you know, sort of HR management type things. Give us, you know, an example, if possible, of HR management issues you've had to deal with, or an example of one you would dread having to deal with.
Well, HR is a massive part of medical management. So, I mean, there's all sorts of issues around recruitment, of course. There are disciplinary issues. There is conflict within teams. And I think conflict within teams is probably the most difficult thing. I think individual conflict is not necessarily so difficult to deal with, but conflict within a team can be very difficult. And for me, there's a balance between, does it impact on patient safety? So there's so much evidence and so much work that dysfunctional relationships within teams do impact on patient safety. And so I'm convinced they do, and I know they do, but you do need to take balanced views to how much that's the driver for the conversations you need to have with the teams. I think there's something about understanding the history. There's often a lot of history behind these things. So my experience is that, so that's been one of the most difficult things, coming into an organisation where you don't know the history of things. So you have to learn the history, as well as meeting everybody, you have to learn the history of the place and understand the history of the relationships, in order to understand why relationships may not be working. I've sort of had quite a lot of challenges, I suppose, when I started in this organisation. There was a lot of high kind of temporary staff spend, which you do find in some areas of medicine more difficult to staff than others. Some real challenge around some team dynamics for very high performing teams. And then it's a matter of how do you manage that? How do you balance that? Some long-standing issues around behaviour, which hadn't been picked up or addressed, which again, I think is about values and culture, and understanding what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable. And strangely, I think that's the other thing you kind of forget within a group of people who work together for a very long time, that you almost become a work family. Mm-hmm. And so behaviours that really aren't professional and really shouldn't be tolerated in the workplace often do become the norm. I think that's universal, actually, across healthcare. Well, certainly, again, across hospital, but also primary care. Teams which work together for a very long time often can slip into that. And I think it's important to every now and then just pull that back where that's slipped. And in a way, I'm really lucky because I'm a new set of eyes into a place, and I would have. So there are pros and cons about being a medical director in a hospital that you have not worked in yourself as a consultant. But I found that one to be a useful aspect.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, because I suspect, like you said, coming with fresh eyes and with no loyalties either way, you know, it's like being a new parent and no loyalties to any child, and just, creating a new culture, a new family value, a new, you know, company value, organizational values. So then I'll ask a sort of a sensitive question, which is, you know, have you ever been involved in disciplinary actions where you've had to terminate someone's contracts before?
Well, I have, but not in this role yet, I say. I mean, you never know, do you? But yeah. No, but I have. And that's very difficult. It's always very difficult when you have to do that for a whole lot of reasons. One of the things that struck me when, I've been involved in a few cases, across a number of hospitals in that regard. But what strikes me most immediately is almost the unfairness, really, around how doctors are treated versus how other staff members within a healthcare environment are treated. So there are lots of things where, so doctors are managed under a totally different process from everyone else who are on the Agenda for Change staff. And I think doctors don't appreciate perhaps how fortunate they are. And I mean, in a way, you know, that doesn't matter whether it's good or bad. It is what it is. So our disciplinary processes are different. And managing doctors, therefore, means that doctors really do have to, in terms of, they're perhaps held to a, I don't know if they're held to a higher standard, but to some extent they're held to a higher standard. But at the same time, it's really very difficult to remove a doctor for certain things, which if they were not a doctor, they would certainly be dismissed for. And I think that's a really interesting thing. So if something would be gross misconduct if you were a porter, I think it should be gross misconduct if you're a doctor. Mm. I don't think that, that I think raises some really interesting questions, which I'm not sure that the medical profession's quite tackled head on. Mm. And there are sort of historical reasons for that as to why we are where we are. But when that happens, it's always immediate. It's always intensely upsetting. People have trained. I mean, it's very expensive. I mean, just from a completely economic perspective, it's very expensive to train somebody to become a doctor. It's a hugely expensive investment to train somebody to become a consultant. So to dismiss somebody is a massive deal. And it's also the repercussions and the ripples within teams is huge. However, sometimes that can be and has been quite good, shakes up team dynamics. And where it's happened, I've not had any involved, but there are teams I know around, and we probably all know that teams that have been have not functioned well, that the loss of one person who was the disruptive person in the team can really improve the way that team works. And what matters in all of this, of course, is it safe? Is it safe for the patient? Are we providing safe care for our patients? Because if we're not, then all of these other things need to be addressed really promptly.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think, like you said, it takes a lot for a doctor to eventually get their contract terminated. But like you said, it's not unusual either. So I come back to around this point again. How do you manage that conflict, you know, where you're a clinician yourself and sometimes managing clinicians in the same specialty that you work in? How do you manage that balance? You know, we're talking about loyalty earlier on. How do you manage that balance of being an insider yet an outsider at the same time as the leader?
I think it's difficult and it can be really difficult if you've got, you know, you're managing people who are also perhaps your long-standing colleagues or friends even, or people who, you know, clinically you would be relying on. So, you know, somebody I'm going to call at 3 o'clock in the morning to come and help me clinically, you know, that is a challenge, I think, which I don't think necessarily other people in the executive team have. So it is, I think, a challenge that's almost unique to the medical director role. How do you manage that? I suppose you have to be really clear that why you're doing this. You're doing this. It's absolutely not about and cannot be about either personal advancement, personal aggrandizement, promotion of your friends. It is absolutely who is best for the role, who fulfills the criteria best. It is about the process rather than the person. It is about exercising judgment and compassion, I think, but kind of holding yourself to account. And if you, and there are times also being really aware of perhaps conflict of interest. So, you know, you may not be the right person to make a judgment. Mm-hmm. And I think almost the, I don't know, this awareness, I suppose, self-awareness that sometimes you aren't the right person to make the judgment. And the skill is creating a team of people that you can trust, where you can ask somebody else perhaps to step in to help. I think if there are particularly difficult things, you do try. I think there's some virtue in having a small group of kind of senior, doesn't have to be senior, it just has to be people who are open, I suppose, to that awareness, self-reflection, etc., that you can bounce things off. So the role that's most difficult in a way is the responsible officer role. That's quite a kind of, can be quite a difficult role, actually, and that's where perhaps those tensions come in. It's funny things, it's job planning queries, it's things about annual leave, how much can I carry over, can't believe you won't let me carry over an extra day or two, you know, and you know, and that can become really difficult, but you have to be absolutely fair, even-handed.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So we're going to sort of move away from the HR side of things and, you know, come down to how would you describe your management style? You kind of hinted at some of those things earlier on.
Well, how I'd like to think it was is perhaps not how it actually is. I don't know. I'd like to think that I'm kind of consultative and approachable, you know, and that actually I do invite views and opinions. I think I am a problem solver by nature, and I find it impossible, really, and I really tried, but I find it impossible not to see the solution to a problem. I'm totally open to the idea that my solution may not be the best one, but if no better one comes up, then I have a solution. And I think that can be very, that's a leadership failure as well as a strength, because it can be a bit overwhelming for other people who may want to come at things in a slightly different way. So I'm probably a bit too directing, I suppose, in my style. I quite like to be quite challenging. I do think it's quite good to be a bit of a disruptor sometimes, particularly coming into teams where you don't think they're working as well. And I think I quite like that. I think that's quite helpful. It can be very difficult. It can be very, but yeah, I mean, so I'm not answering in terms of, yes, leadership style in that sense.
But the qualities, I think you've mentioned.
The qualities, yeah.
Okay, so I guess we could say those are the qualities that you think are required for a good medical director.
Yes, but I also think you need to, you know, it suits your personality to some extent. You have a style, and some people's style will be very different to mine. They're very successful in the role as medical director. I think a key thing for me is that you should try to say yes if you can. That should be a kind of guiding principle, really. There are sets of rules. Exercise with some judgment and compassion around them. Try and say yes if you can, if it's not going to cause more of a problem. And how do you judge that? And that, I think, is where the kind of years of experience come in. You've got to have some sense of the, for me, the openness, the transparency, the honesty. Some sense where you collaboratively doing this. So I'm not a big fan of the organisation having a kind of management versus doctor culture. So I've come into an organisation where there is quite a lot of that, and I'm working really hard to break that down with very mixed success. Often it doesn't feel like I've made any inroads, and other times it feels like it's very much like that. But I don't think that that is a helpful division at all.
I couldn't agree more with you. I think that comes down to, you know, how clinicians view themselves, if they view themselves as the leaders of the organization or just as people on the front line. So I'll come to our sort of final few questions here. What kind of key performance targets do you set for yourself in this role, and for the organisation as a whole?
Well, I mean, there's some objective measures, you know, which may depend on whatever the challenges are in your particular organisation. So I said, you know, I came into an organisation that had a very high temporary spend, for example. Yeah. So I, said, well, that's obviously an area that needs to be tackled. So, you know, I'm going to set one of my KPIs from an objective measure, which is I need to get that down. And then, you know, various ways one could approach that. But anyway, I have managed to achieve that quite successfully within the year. So there are a number of kind of objective measures, and that will depend on whatever organisation you're in. But then I think they're probably the KPIs which maybe the organisation sets you, which are more strategic, or which you set yourself, and that those are all slightly different things. So the organisation had come to a crossroads kind of in terms of the academic strategy, and so that sits within my portfolio. That's one of my KPIs, which is to develop the academic strategy going ahead, and that's something I haven't fully achieved yet, partly because the changing climate, partly because my attentions have been diverted elsewhere, as has everybody else's. And partly because we're entering a new world, I think, where it's not quite clear the relationships, the academic partnerships, where the money will be, how the funding streams will work, etc. But that doesn't, in any case, that's kind of exciting. So that journey is ongoing. And my own KPIs, I think, is something slightly different, which is my own personal KPIs were simply to come in and get to know the people and the organisation, to have people knock on my door, to feel that people would come and tell me their issues, to be so from that perspective, I think I've been partially successful. I'm not fully there yet. I think you want to make sure that people respect you in the role, and you know, you have to win respect. You don't, and it wouldn't matter whether you've been a clinician in the place or not, you have to win respect in the role. So I think I'm partially there. I do get quite a few knocks on the door, and that's irritating, interrupting, difficult, adds work to your plate, but it's also part of understanding what's going on. So I was lucky that the first 3 months or whatever that I was here, that was pre-COVID, and I spent a lot of time, invested a lot of time in one-to-ones with as many people as I possibly could around the organisation. And that's something I maybe... I would recommend to people. It's not something that a medical director often does, but I know every single consultant. It's a small consultant body, but nevertheless, I know every single consultant, and I've spoken to every single one and had some time with them and with their teams and with their managers and with the back office people, as it were, because I think you need to really understand the organisation and get inside it.
Yeah, and so just on the point you touched on there, how do you build and maintain key relationships for outside of the organisation that are key to the work that's being done in the organisation?
Well, again, I think that's quite difficult because it's about networks and relationships, personal relationships. It's quite hard work. It's not something that perhaps I have some of those relationships already. Some of them I didn't have, and it's about pacing yourself, I think, too, you know, but actually going to meet people. There are networks of, and that's an interesting thing, and I guess that may be different regionally. So there are networks for chief operating officers in North Central London, which is my patch of the world. There is a network for chief finance officers to meet each other. There is a network for HR directors to meet each other. There is no network for the medical directors to get together and meet each other. In fact, people do know each other. You meet people, you make those contacts, but you need to be quite you need to be motivated to kind of do that. The pandemic has strangely helped that, of course, as everybody is just helping each other. And then there are whole lots of other relationships. So as a specialist provider, we're part of a specialist network as well. specialist network of hospitals that do not do the same kind of work as us, and a specialist network that do the same kind of work as us. So there are these kind of parallel relationship networks that you need to build up. So again, I'm not completely there, but I wouldn't expect to be 15 months in, but I am trying to build those relationships. So that's a lot of kind of evening Zoom calls or whatever.
And it sounds like you've done a phenomenal job, especially, you know, during the pandemic. So we've just come to our final questions. You know, you've talked about, you know, building knowledge and sharing knowledge within the silos of the networks and everything else, both formally and informally. For someone who is on that healthcare management medical director journey, or to becoming a medical director, what advice would you give them? What resources are available that they can upskill themselves with that you're aware of?
Well, I mean, a piece of advice that was given to me, which I think is a good piece of advice, was about making sure that you've got someone else to at least to touch base with. So whether that's a coach, a mentor, and by that, you know, I mean a formal mentor as opposed to just a mate kind of mentor or senior. And there are differences, and both are really helpful. I think understanding your support network and what is going to be your support network, there are times when it's intensely unpleasant. You know, there's a lot of unpleasant stuff that you might have to deal with. So I certainly have days where every call is just more stressful and distressing than the last, and a kind of, so how are you going to cope with that kind of pressure? It's very busy, and there is a lot of responsibility, and you have to be willing to hold that, and there's a lot of risk that you have to be prepared to hold. So I think what would I say is about consider your personal resilience strategies. Think about how you build that up. Think about who is your network for support. Invest in some time actually to learn the rules. You know, there are some rules around process. If you're going to be a medical director, understanding actually what appraisal and revalidation is about, actually learn, you know, invest perhaps, read the terms and conditions of the contract for both junior and consultant SAS doctors, etc., so that actually you understand a bit about the rules of engagement. Certainly train in, do some case management training for disciplinary processes. I think all of those things have been tremendously helpful for me, in that I actually feel I've got a good ground rock. And I think for doctors, if you're going to become a medical director, you will typically be a doctor. We like to be in a position of knowing that we're competent at something. So actually having got that knowledge base and knowing that you're competent at it is really a good place. You feel more confident and able to make these difficult when you have kind of got difficult conversations. And I think there's something about spending some time in management, shadowing somebody in management. People are really keen, and I'm sure, you know, I think there's always that's helpful. Go and sit with people who have styles that are very disparate, different techniques work different times. I don't normally encourage people to have any children at all. I have three, but I don't, you know, it's been a night, you know, they're hard work. It's not a nightmare, but it is hard work. But I would say that parenting has been perhaps my most useful training. So a bit of UN negotiation skills is always helpful, So those are all ways that you could train to help yourself to become a successful medical director, I think.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for sharing those insights. We're truly, truly appreciative of that. And thank you for coming on.
Pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for having me.